Women, if you want to realize yourselves, you are on the eve of a devastating psychological upheaval. All your pet illusions must be unmasked. The lies of centuries have got to go. Are you prepared for the wrench? There is no half measure, no scratching on the surface of the rubbish heap of tradition will bring you about reform. The only method is absolute demolition. Cease to place your confidence in economic legislation. You are glossing over reality. These are the opening lines of the Feminist Manifesto, penned in 1914 by Mina Loy, the subject of our show today. Greetings, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Mina Loy was a visual artist and designer, an actor on the cutting edge of modernism in the early 20th century, but it is perhaps for her poetry that she remains so remarkable. Carolyn Burke, whose biographies of Lee Miller and Edith Piaf have been featured here before, has written the authoritative biography of Loy, Becoming Modern, The Life of Mina Loy. We'll talk with Carolyn in just a moment. Later in the broadcast, we'll hear from our regular commentator, author Barbara Quick, with her review of Kate Atkinson's Life After Life. Perhaps Mina Loy fell into obscurity because she was not a self-promoter of her work. Though we find drawings of James Joyce and Sigmund Freud sketched by her, and she shows up in the avant-garde circles of Paris and New York, we are largely unfamiliar with her graphic work, her social critiques, and her densely rich poetry. Her work is being rediscovered by young readers and academics alike, in no small measure due to Burke's groundbreaking biography. Carolyn became interested in Mina Loy when she was living in Paris herself as a young woman, and I'm as interested in Burke's process as I am in her subjects. I recently had the pleasure of talking with her in the living room of her Santa Cruz home, surrounded by some of Mina Loy's art. I am pleased to bring you my conversation with Carolyn Burke on Mina Loy. Yes, Carolyn, it's a big, long book you wrote, and I think this was your first biography, yes?
It was, yes. I didn't know what I was doing, so I just kept researching and researching and researching, and that produced a really big book.
And this does seem to be a book that people refer to a lot about Mina Loy. And Mina Loy was at the vortex of huge cultural shift at that time in history. And you place us, the reader, right there.
I'm so glad that you read it that way, Suzanne. That was what I was trying to do, and it perhaps is why the book had to be the length that it is and had to take the time that it took me, because I needed to situate her in the context of so many art and political movements, and it took time to work out her relations to the key players and her effect on some of them. All of this had to be carefully woven to demonstrate just how remarkable her development was.
Her place was not minor, but yet many of us are more familiar with Gertrude Stein, for instance, though we may not have ever read anything by her or about her. She was that fixed. But Mina Loy, people maybe say, don't you mean Myrna Loy?
Yes, they do. And for a long time, just for a joke, I used to refer to this book as Not Myrna, because that's what everyone thought. It took quite some time to feel confident that her story was worth telling nonetheless, because she had been so gifted in several art forms, the main ones being painting and poetry. And because she had lived through these remarkable times of change, as you said, always somehow turning up at the very center of what was most radical and most lively at the time.
Do you think that her nature seemed to be not always fixed in a way? Perhaps it started in her childhood, in the relationship in her family, her desire for freedom, the denial of that freedom at some times, her Jewish father, her Christian mother, her unhappy mother. And it seemed like that's something that created a pattern in her life.
Yes, I would agree. I think she was a person with many inner divisions. She saw herself that way when she wrote her autobiographical pieces. You mentioned the Jewish father and the Christian mother. That was perhaps the first and one of the most painful kinds of ways that she felt divided within herself. Another more interesting, although that is not uninteresting, that initial conflict that she internalized, but another one is that she was so talented both as an artist and as a poet that in her later life she was quite uncertain about how to treat the things that interested her, the theme. She was never quite certain whether she should pursue the one art form or the other. That too was an important and confusing division. There are many more.
Was it something in her own nature or her, I don't like to use the term lack of ambition, because I think she, as an artist, as a writer, she was tenacious, but yet never maybe popped through in a big way so that we recall her. But thanks to your book, and it seems like there is a resurgence of interest in her. But why do you think that she did not become kind of an icon?
Partly it was her upbringing. Her late Victorian family had no expectations for her other than marriage. She was not given consistent or even appropriate education. Everything she learned, she had to learn pretty much by herself. And while being an autodidact fires up some people's temperaments, for her, it reinforced her self-doubt. So I think she never really thought of herself as a person who could be a professional anything. Now, that would not have been unusual for a girl and a young woman born in 1882 as she was. Into the middle class, I should say. Young ladies were not expected to do very much except be decorous wives and companions to those who were going to support them, and mothers, of course. So she didn't have anything like what we would call a role model to suggest that she might have done more with her talents. When she first met Gertrude Stein in Florence, Gertrude made a huge impression on her for any number of reasons, but one of them was that she was a woman who took her writing seriously and would do it no matter what.
Well, I want to explore how you approached the writing of this book. It seems like it might have been a life-changing experience for you too, Carolyn. The depth of work you obviously put in, the way you write the book, not quite from the point of view of Mina Loy, but there's a voice of intimacy with her and maybe how she was reacting to the people and situations around her. So in your subsequent biographies, you do infuse it with that sort of not standing really far back, but getting really close to your subject.
I think that's the way I have been able to write. Up till now, I've needed to live almost intimately in my imagination with my subjects, starting with Mina. And because I spent the most time on that book, researching and writing, as I said, because I didn't know what I was doing, it being the first one, I must have indeed been very, very close to my subject while also trying to maintain enough distance to understand her and understand the workings of her imagination. I did have dreams of her, and I also became involved in a rather complicated and yet fruitful way with members of her family, which is inevitable when you get involved in, what shall we call it, deep biography of this kind. So yes, I was very close to her in a number of different ways, even to the point of finding myself being annoyed or irritated with people who were unkind to her on her behalf. It was when I saw that I was reacting very personally that I realized I had to step back and take a little distance just the same.
Well, you probably read everything she wrote that you could get your hands on, and some of that writing, her poetry, I think takes study, and so you must have spent a lot of time in that kind of study of her work.
Yes, that's true. In those days, I had just come from an extended period of teaching English literature at the university level, and so I was a trained and, one could say, practicing literary critic, which helped me to read her rather difficult and highly original poetry. But I should also add that because in those days I was involved in the feminist movement of the 70s, I felt an immediate sympathy with a lot of what she had to say. Although her poems were written in the 1910s, it seemed to me that they could have been written by a contemporary in the 70s. And so that helped me understand what she was about and try to explain that to my readers. But having the background that I had in English literature certainly helped. Had I not known about Gertrude Stein, Ezra Pound, others who were her friends and contemporaries, it would have been more difficult.
I found myself checking on people that I wasn't highly familiar with, finding out who they were and how they influenced her, but more so how they influenced everything else around us. So that was something that at one point while reading, I just thought, I just can't keep doing this, you know? And I thought, no, I think this is just going to unfold to me. And so it did.
I'm glad.
Yes. So I want to get back to this relationship with her family that she then left England. She was born in England, and she left there, and it was almost like she was fleeing. That was not the place she wanted to be or live or be reminded of.
No, she very much wanted to put England behind her, and in particular her family, but in general what she saw as the hypocritical Victorian standards that constrained and repressed anybody who had some imagination, particularly if it were a woman. So she wanted to find more scope, more freedom, more people like herself. She wanted to find people who would stimulate her imagination and encourage her. And so she went to Paris, a very reasonable choice, although exceptional, since normally a middle-class father would not allow his daughter to run off to Paris in 1903. And for a time, that was the place that nourished her and gave her the opportunity she was seeking as an artist, although it also complicated her life when she married her first husband. But she seemed always to be looking for kindred spirits. Who isn't? So when they moved to Florence, because you could live on better on less money there, she also quickly made the acquaintance of the local artists and writers, and then progressives, radicals like the Italian Futurists, because she was a woman possessed of a desire to know what was going on, take part in it, become modern, as I tried to suggest in my title. And so each place that she went to, she sought out and was quickly embraced by people of her own sort.
And she was intensely beautiful as well.
Yes, I think that this in some respects helped her and in other ways did not. She found herself in the position of the beautiful woman who excites interest in others, one assumes, or she assumed, largely because of her good looks. And so she often felt that her brain and the rest of her talents and skills were not taken as seriously until she got older. That we've talked about before, actually, that pattern. But she was certainly taken up by a number of men who were interested in her because of her extraordinary beauty.
And in some ways defined her early life and her early art, and even contributed to her early successes, it seems, at least with her first husband. She had children all by different men, and she herself was conceived out of wedlock. Do you make anything of that?
Yes, it is a recurrent thread, although it was difficult to find the way to talk about how this shows up in her own life, because I didn't want to distress family members who did not want this information aired. But without any doubt, she did have real problems with the whole issue of paternity, marriage, whether or not she wished to belong to anyone in the way that a woman was said to belong in those days before World War I. And this was part of her rebelliousness and unconventional behavior that may have cost her in terms of both her social situation and her artistic practice.
Let alone her relationships with her family. So you met and talked with members of her family.
Yes, I was fortunate. I was able to interview her elder daughter, Joella, extensively. Joella Beyer, as she became, was very gracious, had me come down to stay with her in Santa Barbara. And we did so many interviews that it would practically comprise a book. Now, it was Joella who did not want these matters to be aired. So when I chose to refer briefly in the book, I did it in such a way that I thought was honest and true, but also not in any way sensationalized. I saw very early on that Joella was quite eager to have me write this book, in part because, as she told me finally, she wanted to do justice to Mama, as she called her, in part because they had had a terrible relationship. And so for her daughter, this was a way of finally settling her distressed and difficult feelings about her own mother. Now, that's a very peculiar situation to find yourself in as a biographer, although one that one can feel sympathy for at the same time as a daughter. You asked earlier about what this meant in my life. It became very clear to me as I looked at the stories of Mina's mother, Mina's own life, and the lives of her two daughters, that these unresolved relationships, particularly those between mothers and daughters, get passed on from one generation to the next. It was so clear to me because of being able to stand back from their situation, at least. So I resolved that I would do the best I could to have a better relationship with my own mother as a result of working through the life of Mina Loy.
An unanticipated benefit, so.
Yes.
I mean, on that same vein, I couldn't help but to think that her mother and her mother's bitterness and distance and restrictive nature came right out of her own situation of conceiving out of wedlock, of maybe having her own dreams dashed. It was not an easy time to be a woman.
Not at all. And I wish I knew more about Mina's own mother. It was hard to see her in a sympathetic light because the only information I had really came from Mina. So naturally it was colored. But what you just said is surely right. And the two ought not to have married, the mother and the father. But given the fact that she was pregnant, he did the right thing, and perhaps he did have some fondness for her. However, as you noted, the pattern recurs again in Mina's own life, which just underscores what we said a moment ago, the way in which these patterns, if they're not dealt with, recognized, can keep cropping up again and again.
You mentioned her letters, and the book is seamlessly, really, threads her own words through it. I'm just intrigued with how you did that, and did you somehow storyboard the work or the letters, or how did you catalog that kind of thing?
I wish I had known how to storyboard. It might have helped me. What happened was I became quite entranced with each phase of her life. For example, when she was in Florence and having a great old time with the revolutionaries who called themselves futurists, I read everything I could get my hands on, which would have constituted a small library, about the Italian futurists. And I went to Florence to find out more and visit her home there. So I think I would become immersed in a particular time and place and set of people as long as I needed to feel that I understood what she was doing there. And I was practically writing a mini book in each chapter, you might say, although I also had to teach myself how to find the narrative threads that ran all the way through. So it took me much longer than any other book, let's say about 15 years, because she moved through so many times and places, from Paris in the post-impressionist days to Florence to New York during the Dada period, back to Paris when the Surrealists were prominent, and so on and so on, perhaps most delightfully to Mexico during the revolution when she was following the man who became her second husband. Each of those periods, phases, movements required in-depth study, and for me perhaps took longer than it might have someone else, but I enjoyed what I was doing. And the result, I hope, allows us to understand how she coped with what she found herself in the midst of.
You are listening to my conversation with Carolyn Burke on Becoming Modern, The Life of Mina Loy. Let's take a short break and listen to a piece of music inspired by Loy's poetic masterpiece, Lunar Baedeker, performed by the Aquatic Lights, along with a reading from one of Mina's many polemical essays. It's a novel idea. We'll be right back.
Censorship may be suitable to the haziness of the social morality, and censors might hold on to their authority forever if censorship had not defeated its own aims. As long as any social misbehavior is not official, when it becomes accepted behavior, the censor represents no electors. There is no secret to be kept when all are in the secret. The censor is sufficient unto himself. Dare him to produce a single individual of the moral negativism that he pretends he strives to protect, and he will be unable to do so. No one aspires to put any restriction on his own amoral sophistication. The public to whom the censor defers exists only in its supposing that public to exist somewhere else. The worst kind of sex maniac is the censor. With their canine affinities, they can only sustain their sexual potentiality by sticking their noses into their neighbors. Hitherto, it has been said that a period of sexual liberty precedes a period of degeneration. The present tendency toward sex liberation should, understandingly and purely directed, inaugurate a period of regeneration. If, as Freud infers, religion and sex are interchangeable, why not integrate both, giving the people an impetus toward the equilibrium they require? Sexual myths become the masters of civilization.
You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I recently visited with author Carolyn Burke, whose previous work includes Lee Miller, A Life, and No Regrets, The Life of Edith Piaf. Her first book, Becoming Modern, The Life of Mina Loy, helped bring this artist out of obscurity while shaping Burke's style as a writer who gets inside the emotional life of her subjects. I spoke with Carolyn at her Santa Cruz, California home.
Tell us how she surprisingly ended up in Aspen.
Well, her daughters were living in New York and had brought her back from Paris just in time, just before the outbreak of World War II, a very wise move. They didn't want their elderly mother living in Paris when the Nazis were likely to invade just about at any moment. And so they did find a way to bring her to New York and have her live there first with one or the other of them and then on her own, where she lived in a kind of a wonderful artistic communal household. But by the mid-50s, she was already 70 and not doing as well. Plus, they didn't like the idea of their mother consorting with all these bohemians and the various bums who lived nearby on the Bowery who adopted her and whom she quite enjoyed. So they brought her to Aspen, where both daughters were living. One, Joella Beyer, was there with her husband, Herbert Beyer, the Bauhaus architect, who was helping to redesign Aspen and build its cultural facilities and really turn it into the place that we now think of. The other daughter, the younger one, was also married to an architect who was involved in the renovation of Aspen. And so they brought their mother there, which was a very unlikely choice for a person like Mina Loy. It was Aspen in the old days, before it became the extremely expensive and glamorous place that it is now. So she found a few friends, like-minded people, and she liked to go to her favorite cafe to talk poetry with them. But just the same, I think she probably would have been better off in a big city.
So she continued to have a probing spirit. And yet her publications were not always coming. And was she trying to publish something yet near the end of her life?
Well, she never tried herself. What she wanted, because she considered herself an amateur, was that other people would take her poetry and order it and put it in order and submit it for publication and take care of all the details. She did not have the understanding of how you go about submitting. Also, she wouldn't have wanted to bother with that sort of thing. She was much more up in the air than that. And I suppose she would have been glad if her daughters had been able to do it. In fact, they did type her poems for her and do what they could. She said later in life also that she really didn't feel that she had it in her to write much anymore, whereas she could still paint, which was her first art form. It was interesting that in her old age, she preferred to go back to what she had done as a young woman before she discovered poetry.
And there are examples of her early paintings and sketches. She seemed to have a real ability in her sketches to capture the character of her subject. Did you have the opportunity to see any of her work?
Yes, and we can look at one. I have it upstairs. It's a very remarkable story. I interviewed Peggy Guggenheim, who was a friend of Mina Loy's. I went to Venice and visited Peggy Guggenheim in her palazzo. Peggy Guggenheim told me quite a bit, but it was her son, Peggy's son, after her death, who said, you know, I have a work by Mina Loy, and I don't know what to do with it. Would you like to have it? So I naturally said yes, and did everything I could to make it possible to bring it back from Venice, which is a long story, but I now have it upstairs, so we can go and examine it if you like. It's called House Hunting, and it's one of her metaphors, I think, moving from place to place and having great difficulty ever holding on to any abode. She often thought about the meaning of housing, being housed. Women in those days so often either didn't have the right to have homes in their own names, or if they did, lost them to their husbands when there was a divorce, as there was in her case. So this work is called House Hunting, and you'll see it has little collage-like fragments of buildings she might have imagined or once lived in. And she set them around a very lovely portrait of a woman who seems to be dreaming of the domestic life that she led in some of these places, and yet they're all in fragments. She did these pieces when she was living in the communal household just off the Bowery. And so some of the themes of poverty, of, again, not exactly homelessness, but difficulty around the issue of being housed properly or consistently, crop up in these pieces. She was always reflecting on her own circumstances and the circumstances of those around her. Because she had a metaphysical bent, or a probing mind, as you said, she drew on these issues in both her poetry, when she was still writing, and in her artwork.
You had just mentioned that this book took you 15 years to write, and you mentioned you spoke with her daughter and Peggy Guggenheim and scores of other people, I'm assuming. And as a biographer, this was your first book. What in you prompted you to have the chutzpah to contact these people?
That is a very good question. I don't quite know how to respond. I'll say only this. When I first learned about Mina Loy, I was living in Paris. And when I read her poems, I really was amazed by them. As I said, they seemed like the work of a contemporary. My own life changed dramatically. I left Paris and came to live in California. The only connecting thread at the time seemed to be my work as a literary critic and as a reader of expatriate memoirs. So I decided, even though I had removed myself to California, I would continue to work on Mina Loy and try to find out more about how it was that she was so talented in both poetry and painting. I wanted to see the correspondences in her two arts. But I needed a biography of her. I needed to know more about her. There was none. And it occurred to me in one of those amazing moments of intuition that perhaps I should write one. So I began, not knowing what that meant. But by hook and by crook, I found myself knowing more about Mina Loy than most people, and finding that it wasn't so difficult to gain access to those who had known her. Many people were still alive. And I should say that because I was able to go back to Paris, I could approach them before it was too late. Some wonderful women who knew her back in the 1910s in New York, like Gabrielle Buffet Picabia, the wife of the Dada artist Francis Picabia, who was a musician in her own right, and other people of that sort, were glad to talk to me. So I was able to build from there. But it did take a kind of leap of faith to think, yes, I can write this woman's life. And fortunately, I didn't know just how complicated it would be, or I might never have done so. Mina's life had to be woven on a vast tapestry. And I think I kept reverting to visual metaphors, if not storyboards. I needed to see each phase of her existence and each set of friends and as a separate group. At one point, a friend said to me, "You've got a whole salon going in your head." And I suppose I did. I didn't know how to do it any other way. Outlining was insufficient. I just lived with it. And when it was going well, the writing would carry me to the next scene. I do remember being stuck at points when I couldn't get Mina, for example, to get on the train and go from Florence to Rome as soon as I needed her to do so. And it took some doing that I, as narrator, could kind of urge her to get a move on. I entered into such a funny kind of imaginative relationship with my subjects, and particularly with Mina, that I think it was all going on in me in some way rather than in a purely external, in a more external fashion on a storyboard.
Your three biographies, as we talked about previously, there is kind of a confluence of place and maybe even a certain ethos that draws these people together. And in the current thing you're working on, I wonder if each one of your previous works somehow prepares you for the next. And Stieglitz, is he involved in...
Yes.
And I don't know if you want to talk about what you're doing now, but I'm awfully curious about it.
Well, at the moment, it wouldn't be good to say too much. However, I can say that I'm awfully glad to see some of the same people coming back into the current story, whom I met and hung out with when writing Becoming Modern. You mentioned Alfred Stieglitz, the great photographer and gallerist who was really responsible for bringing modern art to the U.S. He first published Mina's poetry in his magazine Camera Work, this remarkable art periodical from the 1910s, which he invented and edited. So she was tremendously grateful to him. I was reading his letters recently for the new project, and lo and behold, he mentioned that extravagant creature, Mina Loy, who had just stepped into the gallery to introduce herself. So I thought, well, isn't this good? You know, one book has indeed prepared me for another, and I'm not, at sea by any means. Marcel Duchamp is another connecting link who keeps showing up. It's because I'm really in my books telling the story of modernist art, particularly as it comes to America in this new project, having examined the various phases of modernist art and writing in Europe in the earlier books. I think that's prepared me to some extent to talk about the modernists in this country who decided to stay at home. They didn't want to go off to Paris, as most people who had the opportunity to do so did in the 1920s. They deliberately chose to work with American scenes and motifs and to create a homegrown modernism. So yes, these books are all connected. But I had no idea about that when I started. It must be my attempt to understand some aspects of the 20th century by writing about, first of all, the lives of artistic and unconventional women, and then setting them in the context in which they did what they could.
That, I think, is a thread I see in the three books that I've been exposed to. This, I don't know if I want to use the word proto-feminism, maybe, but it does seem that there is this kind of grappling with the role of women in literature, the role of women in art, the role of women with men.
Yes, and I should point out that Mina Loy wrote a feminist manifesto in 1914, a very odd one, a very unusual one, because she was in Florence at the time, so cut off from the English and American feminists that we might know better, but also because she wrote it in response to the misogynistic aspects of the Italian futurist writings. So this is a kind of feminism. It's even related to what we might think of as first wave feminism at the earlier part of the 20th century. And because I myself was involved in the later phases of the movement, naturally I wanted to find out, where did this come from? Who were our forebears? What were they thinking? What kinds of difficulties did they encounter? And in lots of ways I found that very little had changed.
They were also dealing with the technology, and it is infused in the work. I'm trying to recall. I just have the image of one of the pieces about that she wrote about pistons moving, and that there. And we're at much that same kind of juncture with technology taking a different turn now.
Yes, you're quite right. The Italian futurists are so interesting for any number of reasons. They were both very progressive and very regressive in some respects, but they were fascinated by the modern world, by machinery. One wonderful term I ran across when I was doing the research on that period was moderna latria, the worship of the modern, a sort of idolization of the modern. Marinetti loved machines. Many of the French were also madly in love. The French intellectuals and artists like Picasso and Braque would go out to the airports and aerodromes and look at the helicopters and early airplanes. They saw this as the dawn of a brave new world. It was impossible to foresee the downside of all these dazzling technological achievements. But yes, in the poetry and in the art and in some of the political language of the time, you find very interesting responses to the new technologies, just as you said, we are dealing with in different ways right now.
Again, getting back to her writing, it does have a contemporary feel to it. And just the title of the book, Becoming Modern. And I want to say you talk about her becoming Mina. And maybe you could talk a little bit about her own identity. It seemed like she went by very many names before she settled on her own identity.
Yes, I organized the book in some sense with that in mind because of the name changes. I think that for women, of course, name changes are so important and so complicated as well as revealing. She began life as Mina Gertrude Lowy, L-O-W-Y. Her father's name was easily identified in England as a Jewish name, and so her mother did her best to pronounce it differently so that people wouldn't suspect, which is a sort of a sad and comical bit of information. Almost as soon as Mina could, once she was in Paris and was an art student, and a rather successful one at that, recognize quite early on, she took the W out of her name and she became Mina Loy, L-O-Y, thereby removing the telltale sign, and also, I love this bit, declaring in French that she was a law or a loi to herself. Being someone who was very sensitive to language and able to play with it, I think that she was quite deliberate about this name change for all the reasons I've just pointed out. Then she married her first husband, who was an English art student whom she met in Montparnasse and who got her pregnant, and had to take his name. His name was Stephen Hawes, which was spelled H-A-W-E-I-S. We're almost in Downton Abbey territory. I think you can imagine how the name was pronounced and how much extraordinary snobbery prevailed in what was called Anglo-Florence, where they went to live among the wealthy, artistically minded English expatriates. She detested that husband. Within a short time, she was making all possible plans to shed him and his name, which she did, when she decided to use what became her professional name, in a sense, although she was never very professional, as we said earlier. She called herself Mina Loy and came to New York during World War I, thinking that she would be able to make a go of it there once she and Stephen had separated, and was from then on known as Mina Loy. But she took yet another name after marrying the great love of her life, the very legendary and mysterious boxer poet Arthur Craven, whose own name was yet another pen name. His actual name was Fabian Avenarius Lloyd. So when she married him in Mexico, in the most marvelous time of her life, I think, in some respects, she became Mina Lloyd, which, quite remarkably, was a way of encapsulating her chosen name, because L-O-Y fits very nicely inside Lloyd, double L-O-Y-D. So the permutations and combinations of her names, chosen and taken, are a whole little poem in themselves.
You mention Craven, her boxer poet husband, and maybe you could tell us a little bit. He had a very mysterious ending.
Yes, he did. The first thing about him, I should say, for people who don't know him, is that he was a nephew of Oscar Wilde, and his mother, to escape the scandal caused by Oscar Wilde's trial and conviction for homosexuality, took the whole family to Switzerland, where young Arthur grew up, knowing that he was part of the Wilde family. So he was sort of bent on being unconventional. It was as if he came by it naturally. But he had to flee the draft, or chose to flee the draft, during World War I, because he was subject to it as an English subject. I think that's why he chose to flee. But he did so by coming to New York, as did many other expatriate artists of a pacifist bent, people like Marcel Duchamp, Picabia, Mina, and many of their friends. Well, what happened? The United States declared war on Germany in 1917. So suddenly this whole group of artists and intellectuals were persona non grata in New York, because they were once again liable for military service and also seen as suspicious, possibly subversive agents. So Craven fled to Mexico, as did a number of left-wingers at the time, and Mina followed him. What happened was that they didn't fare well. They eventually found themselves in dire straits, impoverished, and he came up with a crazy plan to fix up an old leaky boat and sail down the coast of Mexico and eventually make his way to Latin America. Well, when he was fixing up this boat and Mina was sitting on the shore mending the sail, he disappeared. No one has ever known exactly what became of him, but it seems likely that he drowned, given both the very dangerous tides in that part of Mexico and the fact that he had an old leaky boat and was not a very experienced sailor. But she mourned him for the rest of her life, and rumors circulated. People said they had seen him here, they had seen him there. So she never quite knew whether he might have abandoned her, although I doubt that that was the case.
Thank you. I was anxious to talk to you about this book and about your experience writing it. I guess I find the work that you do quite fascinating in your ability to dive in to your subjects in a way that humanizes and explores their context.
Thank you. I'm glad when I reach readers like you and the many others who have said similar things. I've been particularly happy to meet other women and men for whom these subjects are of real importance in what they do. I think that obviously there's some way in which I needed to understand myself and where I came from, even though I wasn't part of these art movements. But I wrote to share my understanding with others for whom the life of the artistic imagination is of real importance.
And you yourself are an expatriate.
That's right, which is probably why I was drawn to Mina in the first place. I was born in Australia, in Sydney, and was taken to live in the U.S. when my mother remarried when I was a child, but always knew that I was a foreigner, even though I did my best to assimilate and was indeed naturalized. I found a kind of substitute homeland, I suppose, in books and in my imagination, and then for a time a real homeland in France, where I first discovered Mina Loy and began writing about her and the worlds that she inhabited. It's pretty clear to me that all of this was necessary for me to, in some way, enrich my own experience, having lost contact for a long time with the place that I came from, which I now am about to visit again.
Well, thanks so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Carolyn Burke speaking with me in her Santa Cruz home about the life and work of Mina Loy. I hope you'll pick up Carolyn's biography, Becoming Modern, The Life of Mina Loy. Finally, author and screenwriter Barbara Quick, whose work includes Vivaldi's Virgins and A Golden Web, with her review of Kate Atkinson's Life After Life.
Hooray! Another brand new novel I can heartily, unabashedly recommend. Life After Life, the newest book by the Whitbread Award-winning British novelist Kate Atkinson, is start to finish a feast for the reader. The story is riveting, the novel's concept is bold, and the author is a wordsmith of the highest order. The novel leapfrogs back and forth in time between the birth of its protagonist, Ursula Todd, into a deliciously evoked 1910 Edwardian England, through the terrors and deprivations of the two world wars. But this is no straight-on historical novel. Ursula dies in the first version we hear of her birth, on page 7. And then that fiercely snowy day of her birth is revisited again and again in the early parts of the novel until the baby manages to live. Of course, the author is managing to let her live, allowing someone to come along and help the doctor through the snow, giving Ursula's mother the prescience to equip herself with a small sharp knife she can use to cut the umbilical cord wrapped around her baby's neck. This is a novel full of second chances, with a protagonist who, in one lifetime, manages to make great evolutionary strides. Like many celebrated literary writers, Kate Atkinson has a love of and flair for mystery. She followed her stunning award-winning debut in 1995 behind the scenes at the museum with four mystery novels that have no doubt made her fortune, having been turned into a successful British television series called Case Histories. Life After Life is a what-if rather than a whodunit, a literary novel that nonetheless has tremendous commercial appeal and manages to turn all the rules of proper storytelling on their head. What if, the author makes us ask ourselves, we knew in advance the deadly traps that life will set for us and our loved ones? What if, equipped with that knowledge, we were given a second, third, or even fourth chance to reshuffle the details that conglomerate into what becomes the narrative of our life and death? What would we change? What would we sacrifice to make things come out differently? If you're looking for a great book to read this summer, or if you're choosing novels for your book group's upcoming season, you can take my word for it that Life After Life delivers the goods. This is Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Thanks for joining us. You can listen to our podcasts at krcb.org or subscribe to them and listen on iTunes. We've had production assistance from Wendy Nicholson and Sean Knight. I'm Suzanne Lang. We'll go out with a piece by Thurston Moore titled Mina Loy. It's a novel idea.